Arthur Brown Jr. is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Brown to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state that carries out a third of U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Pat McCann, and Merrill Pontier, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Schneider, general reporter Clint Young, and special guest Rob Owen, a Capitol appeals attorney who has argued and won 4 death penalty cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. The execution watch for Arthur Brown Jr. begins.
Tonight, the state of Texas ushers Arthur Brown into the death chamber. To our listeners around the world, thank you for joining us on this Thursday, March 9th edition of Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for Progressive Forum with Wally James on KPFT Houston, they will be back next week in their regular Thursday 6 o'clock time slot. This show brings you live news coverage as the state of Texas executes 52-year-old Alabama native Arthur Brown, convicted in 1992 of slaying 4 people in southwest Houston during an alleged drug purchase. Mr. Brown has been on death row in Texas since 1994. This is the second scheduled execution date this week, and this is Mr. Brown's second scheduled execution. Joining us is our reporter outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas, activist Linda Schneider. Hello, Linda. Any news?
Not yet. No one has crossed over yet.
Do we know who is standing witness for Arthur Brown?
Who is standing witness?
No appeals left, so I'm not sure. Witness? Thank you for helping to stop executions.
Who is his witness tonight? Because his son is out here.
The next media so long. I know, but
I'm not sure because his son is out here with us.
I saw Channel 2 from Houston.
And for those listening around the world, explain what signal you are looking for to know that the execution is about to begin.
I messed it up Tuesday night, and the person wasn't pronounced dead until...
For those around the world listening, Linda, tell us which signal you're looking for to let us know that the execution is about to begin.
We're looking for the news media to cross over.
I know, and then the after news, the news media goes across the street,
then the family will go in if there's a witness. But most specifically,
and I believe you have somebody there with you. You have Ali Sullivan, friend of Arthur.
Should be reported. Yes. I know. Walking in there with the media.
Allie is an activist as well. She's with the Death Penalty Action Group, and she's a friend of Arthur Brown. Hello, Allie. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Arthur, please.
I've only known Arthur probably 8-ish months, but Arthur is, he's a very special person. What?
If you don't mind, get a little closer to the mic and talk a little louder for us.
Is this better?
Yes.
I've known Arthur maybe 8 months or so. I was introduced to him by a former inmate at Polunsky Death Row who has since been executed. And it was this inmate's dying wish for me to reach out to Arthur and try to help him. And for a long time, there was not much we could do to help him because it wasn't until the last few weeks that all of this new evidence came out that the attorneys tried to use to argue to stop his execution. And so for the first several months, a lot of our correspondence was not about his innocence. And I was just talking about kind of whatever we wanted to talk about. And I've come to know Arthur as an extremely compassionate and considerate
person.
Even before I had strong evidence that about his innocence, I was inclined to believe him because he has shown so much sincere care to other people and other people's struggles around the world. Pretty much every single letter, card I receive from him, he's commenting on what other people are going through across the world that he doesn't even know. And every single letter I get from him, he is asking about my family and he's wishing all of us well. And it is just so sickening to think that they are killing this person who cares so much about other people. It is not, like, I cannot imagine somebody who is so concerned about the well-being of other people is capable of such a horrific crime. He's a wonderful person, and this is absolute hell.
They just crossed the line. The witnesses just went across the line.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you. That, for our listeners around the world, that means that the execution is about to begin. If we could, let's go back one a little bit more to Allie for just a second. Allie, did he was on death row for such a long time. From 1994, that's the majority of his life. Did he ever lose hope?
Since I've known Arthur, his spirits have been higher than mine regarding this impending faith. And the last message I received from him was about a day or two ago. And one of the last comments he made in it was, I hope the work of my attorneys will be able to put a stop to their efforts to eradicate my person or something to that effect. And I think he was very aware of the reality, but he wasn't super overt in how he expressed his hope, but I could see that it was there.
Thank you, Allie. Thank you for sharing your knowledge of Arthur with us. We appreciate that.
Can I just make one more comment briefly? Because I know the guys on the row listen to this.
Absolutely.
I just want you all to know, those that are currently on death row at Polensky, that this is a tough day for all of us. And I want you to know that we're not forgetting about you. Those of you that have known Arthur the longest, and I've been the closest with Arthur, thanks for being his friend. We're with you today.
And we are with you today. We are standing outside of the Walls unit in Huntsville. We are standing on the streets in the city of Houston. We are here and we are standing with you. Linda, I know this is just a horrible day for you as well. You have been visiting. You bring so much humanity to this show.
What I know about him and the little bit that I have talked to him, he is was very a genuine person. Just like Allie said, he had a lot of compassion for everybody on the row. I talked to a death row inmate that got off the row today over the telephone, and he's at another unit, and he expressed his terror. I mean, he hated this was happening because he said, of all the people, AJ was a really nice person, and that he was sincerely sorry for everything that happened, but he did not think he was guilty either.
Thank you so much, Linda. And please let us know if you hear anything or when the witnesses come back across.
I certainly will.
Thank you. Joining us to put this case in perspective is Larry Douglas, our chief legal analyst, Houston criminal defense attorney Patrick McCann, criminal defense attorney Merrill Pontier, and our reporter Clinton Young, former death row inmate. I welcome all of you today. Larry, explain this case to us. How did we get here?
Marlo, as you mentioned, this case goes back to 1992. And it comes out of Houston, Harris County, Texas. So when you look at the facts of this case, what stands out a lot is the fact that things have just changed so much in the last 30 years, right here in Houston. The case revolves around a situation where six drug distributors were murdered, execution style. Were shot, execution style. Six were shot. Two survived. So the six that were shot, I guess their names were Jessica Quinones, Jose Guadalupe Tovar, Frank Farias, and Audrey Brown. Those died. And the two remaining, actually Rachel Tovar and Alexander Camarillo, they testified, but they had been shot in the head. Somehow, Arthur Brown and his co-defendants, Marion Dudley and Antonio Dunson, were accused along with Arthur Brown. The ties seemed to be a little bit tenuous. Some of it seemed to be a little bit coerced, in that there was a gun found, and so there was some forensic evidence that was introduced that probably did not tie to Arthur Brown, but at trial it seemed to be placed with Arthur Brown, and that was in the heads of the jurors. There was the testimony of the survivors. Again, I don't want to sound insensitive, but they'd been shot in the head, and there were some incidents where they had difficulty even identifying the, and their testimony was critical in having Arthur Brown found guilty. Their identifications were not totally certain. At some time they misidentified.
What do you mean by that?
In some instances, they couldn't identify him. Okay, so, and early on, but you know, by the time the trial comes around, they were making the identification. So that is of concern. And the other thing that was concerning, we talked about earlier, is the doggone nicknames. Red and Squirt were two of the guys. There was a firearm found back in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where they're from. Another guy, who was also named, referred to as Red. And the thing about that Red that concerns me is that his information was never disclosed to the defense. So they never, somebody by the last name Terrell, it was never disclosed to the defense. The testimony of his sisters, one sister supposedly reported that that Arthur Brown told her that he shot six Mexicans. Now, she later recanted that testimony, and there was some coercive tactics used with her that typically are not used in Harris County anymore. The taking the witnesses who might not be totally cooperative and giving them a place to live, that's locking them up overnight, and carrying them to go testify. Those things were somewhat routinely used. Well, not unusual to be used in Harris County. It's not done anymore. The testimony seemed to be somewhat coercive. And so now, in the light of where we are today and looking back at forensics in today's standards, I think a lot of things would have been done a whole lot differently. And that whole issue of the possibility of actual innocence is now coming strongly to light. And if there were a possibility of actual innocence known to the defense at the time, and a possible witness, another shooter, someone else who might have done it, then the defense would have been on that right away. That's I'm sure where they would have gone if there was some way to say that Red, who's known as Red. I mean, for instance, you know, I've had prosecutors. You know, one time she was explaining to me that one of the things that focused her on the defendant, not a case that I was handling, was that he went by the nickname Pig, and she said she concluded that, you know, that must be him. Well, I went to high school with at least two guys we call Pig. I mean, nicknames are just so prevalent, okay, especially in the black community. But and the name Red, I mean, there are just so many. A light-skinned black guy, is known as red, dark-skinned black guys often known as black. So the identification issue is the one that gives me the most trouble about this case. The other issue is the apparent intellectual disability. I think it fit it, but there's only so much that a defense lawyer can do with limited resources. And to be able to do all the investigation that he needed, I think limited to the defense attorney quite a bit then that I don't think would have happened today. So these are really critical issues that I think the courts should have found a way to look into those issues, especially the possibility of actual innocence. That gives me the greatest amount of concern.
So we're talking faulty DNA evidence. We're talking shaky eyewitnessing. What disturbs you, Pat?
I don't think there was any DNA. I'm not even sure whether there was any at all.
Lack of DNA.
Lack of DNA. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. Let me be more specific about that.
There may have been some. I just don't recall seeing any.
Right.
Look, if I can, probably the most troubling thing is that the retardation standard has shifted in the last 5 years from a case we used to call Briseño. And that was a case where the judges, after the Supreme Court decided that the intellectually disabled should not be executed as a group, they left it to the states to come up with a standard. And the judges on the CCA came up with a standard that was basically created by them and had nothing to do with medical standards for deciding this. Briseño was that standard. In a series of cases that involved Bobby Moore, the Supreme Court overturned that standard in Moore 1, and then the CCA refused to follow their guidance. And so it had to go back up again. And Moore 2 came down and said, we told you that we were serious. This is what this means. Fix this. And the CCA had to give up. Part of this problem is that this retardation evidence has been around for this man for a long time. He was determined to be retarded in grade school. And for those who are hearing this, I'm used to the term because that was in the health and safety code. I will try to substitute intellectually disabled as I can, but I will slip up, so forgive me. But the issue is that under the new standard, he would have been found to be intellectually disabled. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said, well, you should have brought that up earlier, and thus you don't have the standing, and we are calling this an abuse of the writ. That's a horrible way to deal with claims under the Moore cases, because it is very simply, one, the first time they've applied it to a category. So imagine now that you were a juvenile and you were given a death sentence. Apparently, if you didn't raise it before this, apparently that doesn't matter. And the other part of this, and this is a legal standard that other people besides myself have challenged, Texas basically adopted the federal abuse of the writ standard and now tries to pass it off as an independent state reason why fundamental claims shouldn't be reviewed. It's a shell game with people's lives, and that's disturbing on a whole host of levels, but they have not backed away from it. And unfortunately, a very good intellectual disability claim is going to sadly die with this man. And that's a tragedy for everybody. And one that I hope that the CCA will reconsider, because it means that people with very good claims that should be reviewed are being denied review on, I guess, what some folks might call a super technicality. And it's fundamentally unfair.
Is the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, or the CCA, are they appointed or elected?
Well, they're elected in statewide elections. There are nine folks. They some of them run every 2 years for positions. And I believe that they have struggled with the definition of intellectual disability, and now appear to be struggling with granting relief on that basis. I read the petition that Ben Wolf had put in on behalf of Mr. Brown, and he took it to the Supreme Court, and I thought he had a great briefing on that. It was a good issue, and it's fundamentally this question: can a state procedural default, even if it's accurate, and I don't think it is in this case, can it be used to evade the merits of a case where someone's life is on the line, whether they're intellectually disabled, whether they're innocent, whether they're perhaps a juvenile? Those are things that shouldn't be happening in any review of these matters, but it continues to be a problem with state courts that do not wish to grapple with a fundamental merits decision.
In a little while, we're going to be bringing in Rob Owen, who has been, well, he's currently a professor at Northwestern University School of Law, but he's also been an attorney for the Texas Defender Service, and we'll ask him some of these questions and see what he has to say about that. But at this moment, let's bring in Clinton Young and Meryl Pontier. Clinton, did you know Arthur?
I knew AJ. Like, we called him AJ, right?
Right.
But, so that's what I'll call him here. That's how the man introduced himself to me. But I knew him real well. Real quick, I'd like to expand on something that Pat said. You know, he's about when the Supreme Court kicked it back down to the states, and that the CCA sat here and they had the Briceño standard, and they tried to do this, and they tried to do that, and create this standard, this of intellectual disability. Well, the problem is it's not the CCA's responsibility to do that. It's the state legislators' responsibility, which they continue to avoid doing. There's been several bills about trying to properly define, including one that was filed recently in this session about how to define intellectual disability. But for some reason, the legislator keeps kicking the can down to the to the CCA. And in doing so, they end up creating a bigger mess, because you end up with like the Bobby Moore situation. And so, you know, it's not the CCA's job to create these standards. It's the legislator's job. They just don't want to do their job. But as for AJ, yeah, first time I met AJ was on disciplinary level. I was down there for something, getting pepper sprayed or some sort of mischief that I partook in back then. And AJ was a couple cells down from me, and I used to get prison legal news. And so I'd pass it down to him, and he'd read articles, and we'd sit at the door for hours at a time just discussing different things. AJ was a real cool cat, right? I liked him. Later on, I went back to level. And this was something that stood out to AJ. It kind of shows the man that he is, right? Well, no, kind of it does show the man that he is. My birthday is on July 19th. And so back in the day before the cameras was up, if you was on level, then people could send you commissary down there. If he was on disciplinary level, because you couldn't buy commissary while on disciplinary level. And so it was like, matter of fact, it was on my birthday, I get something. And I never would expect this from AJ, because we just talked, a few hours here and there. And then he went on his way and I went on my way, and that was that. But I get it and open it up, and there's a kite in there, and it's from AJ telling me happy birthday. And I mean, there was homeboys that I chopped it up with every day didn't remember what my birthday was, but AJ remembered. And so that's the kind of person that AJ was, right? He had a co-defendant that was executed. It was some years prior, I think probably about 10 years back, 10, 11, 12 years back, right? I was discussing this with Larry before the show started. You know, they executed AJ's co-defendant on the same evidence that they executed. I mean, if it goes forward with, you know, they're going to be able to execute AJ tonight on, that's been challenged. And the merits of this evidence has never been properly analyzed because the court uses abuse of writ standards or immaterial and harmless error. But it's one of those things that I feel,
And as you mentioned, this of course was in Harris County, and we've had a lot of trouble with our crime lab. Has anything ever happened with the crime lab? Any of those cases ever been overturned?
No Texas death penalty case has been overturned because of the Houston crime lab scandal. And there's a multitude of people on death row that, that later on ballistics come out and other things are there's a case, maybe Pat can remember, I can't remember the case right now. I think it's Robbins. It's Ex Parte Robbins, if I'm not mistaken. Where not only the evidence, but also the experts, the scientists, can be called into question, right? And so, so here it is. You had these technicians in the Harris County Crime Lab messing up all these cases. And then the crime lab itself, the physical structure was trash. And, of course, these cases are going to be contaminated or improperly handled. But they don't want to do anything because it opens up the floodgates. You know, if you give one person action because of Houston Crime Lab, then everybody from Harris County that went through Houston Crime Lab is going to file a writ. And that's how the CCA looks at it. So I believe wholeheartedly they'll execute an innocent man before they give it, 10 or 20 guilty people an opportunity to be heard in court.
Is life just that unimportant to the state of Texas?
Well, it's all about protecting their institution. Just like the Catholic Church did with the priests, on and on and on. What happens is you have these people that believe in these institutions, and so it all becomes about upholding that. You know, it's just like they don't want to admit that Todd Willingham was innocent, and they executed an innocent man. And Rick Perry did everything he could to avoid, that committee actually looking into that case. It was for his personal political career and also for the institution. It's the same reason. I mean, for some reason in Texas, these politicians and judges are obsessed with the institution of the death penalty. And after reading over a lot of the bills, there's a bill to wrap it up. There's a bill right now about if a prosecutor and an attorney agree based on new evidence that a defendant should get a new trial, then they can go to the judge and the prosecutor can say, hey, I'm agreeing this guy should get a new trial. He should get 20 years instead of life, but with no parole eligibility. And then the lawyer says, okay, that's a good deal. The judge signs off on it. Bam, that guy gets a new trial. And he can't make parole and he can't appeal. That's actually in the language of the law. But it excludes the death penalty. So they can let 100 people off out of prison that have life sentences for capital murder, but they're trying to pass a law to make it where death penalty cases can't be touched.
Wow.
You know? And so
let me ask the same question to Pat McCann.
Well, first I wanted to talk about our friend's question on that. It was Ex Parte Robbins. Brian Weiss, I believe, handled that on habeas review. That was a capital that was sentenced to life, and the medical examiner later changed their opinion about the death. And all of that comes down to the 11.073 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, and that allows new science to be brought in. And there have been a lot of good changes out of these tragedies. There's 11.073 for new science, which includes DNA that can be brought. There's been the Texas Forensic Science Commission that has done real work in trying to certify the labs independently. So the labs have been moved out from under, except for the DPS, because apparently they're unquestionable despite their own scandals. Most of the major labs have been moved out from under law enforcement and exist independently now. So a lot of good changes have happened, but in the interim, people have gone to the executioner on questionable scientific evidence. And junk science has been one of the biggest problems in all prosecutions, not just the death penalty. And not only junk science, but poorly executed proper science. We've had people who have essentially made up narcotics testing that were working in chemical labs. We've had people who have done what they call dry labbing, where they fake a report. We've had people running businesses on the side, trying to gather information for their own personal gain. So it's a whole series of problems with forensics that are trying to be addressed, but many of them aren't.
Before we go on any further right now, I do want to say that this is, it's 6:30. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. If you have tuned in looking for Progressive Forum, this is a special edition of Execution Watch. We are awaiting word about the execution of Arthur Brown. And Progressive Forum will be back next week. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Let me add something to what Pat said real quick.
Please.
You know, he's right. They have made some changes, and the legislator is receptive. Like I said, I don't know if y'all seen when I talked to him down there in Austin, but everybody said the room was, like, that was out of everybody talked that they was captivated. And several of them came up to me afterwards, and I talked to them, and I've had some phone conversations since then. And so, yeah, like Pat said, there has been changes that came from these other cases. The problem is they don't want to do nothing about the cases, the 20-year-old, 30-year-old, 10-year-old cases of people who are still on death row.
Right.
Like Arthur Brown. If Arthur Brown was tried today, he wouldn't be on death row. He might not even got convicted, more likely than not.
It would have been a completely different case.
Right. It's a totally different case. But they don't want to do nothing because it's a 20 or 30-year-old case. And that's the problem. It's okay. They're fixing the future and saying the hell with the past.
Right. Let's bring in Rob Owen, who is joining us from Chicago tonight. He's a professor at Northwestern University School of Law. He's also an attorney for the Texas Defender Service and a longtime supporter of Execution Watch. Thank you for joining us, Rob.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, he's also a former co-director of the Capital Punishment Center at the University of Texas School of Law, and he has represented over 50 prisoners facing the death penalty. This is somebody that you really want on your side, including arguing and winning four cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Owen, first, may I just start off by saying how very sorry we are for the loss of your friend and client, Henry Hank Skinner.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. There was a memorial service today for Mr. Skinner with his friends and longtime supporters. His lovely wife, Sandrine, was there. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to be present in person, but I did send a statement to be read because I really wanted to express my deep sorrow at Mr. Skinner's death.
You spend a lot of time with Mr. Skinner he certainly was on death row for an extremely long time.
Absolutely. He was on death row from 1995 onward, which is, you know, decades and decades of torture, given that, of course, the conditions of confinement at Polunsky are so terrible. And I think that, in a way, we are glad that he is liberated from that torment, even if it's not the kind of liberation that we all hoped we would see.
Right. I do hear that the men on death row are suing for an end to solitary confinement. How do you think that's going to go?
There's been a lot of success in other states suing over solitary confinement, at least in jurisdictions where, like in Texas, people on death row are automatically put in solitary confinement. In other words, the courts in, I think, Virginia and South Carolina and Louisiana have all said that there has to be some kind of individualized determination that solitary is appropriate confinement for an individual. And even then, it can't be indefinite. It has to be reviewed periodically to make sure that it's still warranted and that the person's not suffering unduly. And I think that in Texas, you know, we have reflexive solitary confinement. They just put everybody who's under a death sentence goes into solitary. And that is exactly the kind of thing the courts have said is not proper. So we're very hopeful that they also have a very good legal team handling that lawsuit. And I'm very hopeful that they will have a successful outcome. Of course, litigation is always uncertain.
Right.
It takes a long time to unfold. You know, it could be more months or even more years before that suit comes to completion. Because, of course, even if at the trial court level, if the federal district court rules in favor of the prisoners, the state can always appeal to the Fifth Circuit and drag it out further. So I'm not sure how long things will take, but we try to be optimistic while things are in motion.
Joining me here at the table is Larry Douglas and Pat McCann, and we were just discussing this particular case. I do want to talk to you about some of the pending bills and what's going on in the Texas legislature, but could they ask you a couple of questions about this case?
Well, of course. I don't know that I have anything that they won't already have thought of or contributed to the conversation, but I'm very happy to field any questions about the case.
Your voice is always a welcome addition, and we appreciate it.
Professor Owen, have you been in contact with any of the folks on the solitary confinement lawsuit, and certainly without revealing any of their strategies, but are they optimistic?
I think you know, Mr. McCann, that so much depends on the judge, and they are presently in front of a judge who, you know, they're cautiously hopeful about, but I also think it's a judge who is known for being a stickler to the law, and so we will have to see how that goes. I have not been in touch with them. I actually know these lawyers because we worked together on a federal death penalty case back in 2020 when the Trump administration was executing so many guys on the federal death row. They joined me on one of my federal cases. And so I do know these lawyers pretty well. I think they're really terrific, but I haven't talked to them about this case for so long. Of course, when they were preparing the lawsuit and investigating, discussing with potential plaintiffs and looking into the conditions at Polunsky, they were being very cautious about trying to sort of keep a lid on what they were doing. And I respected that because I understood they were trying to improve their chances of, you know, getting some people into the case as plaintiffs who could prevail.
Out of curiosity, if this does go through, who would be setting the standards for solitary confinement?
That is an excellent question. I don't know the answer. I mean, I think that we could look to what other states and what the federal government do in terms of when solitary is permitted and for how long. But I don't know. Who will be the person responsible for that? You can imagine a situation where the judge would herself either supervise that or appoint a special master, for example. That's a role that you sometimes see the courts create for someone to oversee changes in a system where the court has said, well, these changes have to be made, but the judge isn't going to do it himself or herself. So they appoint a so-called special master to oversee those changes. And that's certainly a possibility if there's going to be changes in the confinement or in the classification process, which is where that would have to start, I think.
Well, to change the subject, I know that you've been paying attention to the Texas legislature. What are some of the pending bills that could, if enacted, affect the death penalty here in Texas?
There are a number of bills, and I'll just tell you a little bit about them. Everything is still pretty early in the legislative session, so a number of things have been heard in committee. A couple of bills have even been reported out of committee. But it is still a long way from the end of the legislative session, and things, as you all know, will accelerate as we move toward May and June. And so it's not clear exactly how quickly things will start to happen. But just to talk about a couple of the changes that are on the table, one of them is a proposal to create a new procedure for defendants who say that they have intellectual disability. And that's the condition that, of course, for many years was called mental retardation, but is now, you know, the diagnosis has been refined further, and it is a kind of cognitive limitation. The Supreme Court said in 2002 that you can't execute people who have that condition. although sadly, I think Mr. Brown's case today may show that that protection is not always being enforced very meaningfully. So that's a real concern anyway. But there are two separate proposals to create a pretrial process for determining whether someone is a person with intellectual disability. And they include the real difference between the two is one of them would make it a judge determination, where the judge would hear a motion, would hear evidence, would make a decision about it. The other is actually creating it as a jury process. So as your attorney experts are well aware and may have talked about on this or other programs, in Texas, if there is a question about the defendant's competency to stand trial, he has a right to have a jury determine that issue, a separate jury from the trial jury. In other words, you impanel a jury specifically for the purpose of deciding the competency question. And one of these two proposals on the intellectual disability issue would create a similar situation where you would impanel a jury whose only job would be to decide whether or not the defendant was a person with intellectual disability. So, you know, those are, I think that in many cases in the past, the determination of intellectual disability has been left up to the trial jury and often has been given to the trial jury as a separate special issue or special verdict question at the punishment phase. And I think the concern about that is that once the jury has heard that the defendant committed an intentional serious homicide, and once they have heard a lot of evidence about his potential background or perhaps other criminal history, and once they've heard from the victim's survivors about how much they suffered from the defendant's crime, that it's going to be very difficult for a jury at that time to pass an objective, impartial verdict on whether the defendant is a person with intellectual disability, because they're often overwhelmed, I think, by the horror of the crime and by the seriousness of the crime. One of the things about these proposals that would be a positive change is that the one that calls for a jury to decide intellectual disability would provide specifically that the jury would not be death qualified. In other words, in death penalty trials, as you all know, and as I'm sure many of the listeners know, the jury is questioned specially before they're allowed to serve, and they have to basically say that they can imagine a case where they give the death penalty, that they're at least open to giving the death penalty. And that excludes a lot of people who have moral or religious or other objections against capital punishment. The nice thing about this proposal for the intellectual disability jury is that it would not impose those screening questions. So you would have the right for people who were otherwise, you had reservations about capital punishment or were conscientious objectors from that, would be able to sit in judgment on people's intellectual disability. So that would be an improvement. So that's an important bill that's out there and could make some serious changes that would change a lot of things. There are a couple of bills for expanding the death penalty. One of them would make it a death penalty crime to murder a disabled person. That is a apologize for my cat stepping in here. That's a new category of capital murder that hasn't been proposed previously. I'm not sure why the sponsor of that bill thinks that the current laws don't sufficiently protect people with disabilities, but that is one proposal that would slightly expand the scope of the death penalty. Another is in cases where the victim is a police officer or a firefighter, you presently have to prove that the defendant knew that the person was a peace officer or a firefighter before he could be convicted of that particular variety of capital murder. And one of these other proposals would create a legal presumption that if the victim was in uniform, that the defendant in fact knew that the person was a peace officer or a firefighter. So that would reduce the state's burden of proof in cases involving a police officer or firefighter victims. I don't know if that would have a very heavy impact because in my experience, at least most of the cases that involve police officer killings do involve uniformed officers, or, you know, it's extremely rare, I think, for there to be a homicide of someone who wouldn't already fall into that category. So that might not make a very big difference. Couple of bills on the floor about execution procedures. One of them is the recurring issue in Texas of allowing a spiritual advisor for the condemned person to be present during the execution and to be in the execution chamber with the condemned person. That is a right that the Supreme Court appeared to establish in a case last year called Ramirez versus Collier. And unfortunately, TDCJ has not amended their execution procedures to provide specifically for a right to confer with your spiritual advisor or have them present in the execution chamber. So what that has meant is inmates either had to take TDC's word for it that they were going to do that, or they have had to sue. So there have been a couple of cases where it's been necessary for people to bring suit on the eve of execution just to guarantee that TDCJ will do something the Supreme Court has already said they're obliged to do. So thankfully, this proposal, which I think has a very good chance of passing, would require TDCJ to honor those rights. I'll just mention one more, and then one of the practices in Texas that is a matter of great concern is with respect to execution drugs, the chemicals that are used to carry out executions. Those chemicals have an expiration date. In other words, when they are created, which they usually are by a so-called compounding pharmacy, they have an expiration date, just like a box of Cheerios. And the idea is that Texas has been sort of cheating on these expiration dates by sending the drugs. Once they reach the expiration date, Texas has been sending the drugs to sort of outside laboratories that purport to say that the drugs are still effective, notwithstanding the expiration date. And then they've been using those drugs to carry out execution. And there's a lot of medical reason to believe that once the drug passes that expiration date, it becomes actively incapable of causing a painless death and creates a huge risk that people are going to experience grave physical suffering in being put to death. Specifically, the drug, which is a solution, it's a mixture of liquids and solids, it comes out of solution. In other words, the solids and the liquids separate. And at that point, you no longer have phenobarbital. And so the idea that they've been supposedly getting the approval of labs to use these drugs in executions is really disturbing. And there is a bill that would forbid them from carrying out executions with expired drugs. And I think that would be a very positive change. I mean, I hate, as we all do, I think, the idea of tinkering with the execution process. It's like it seems like we ought to go to the heart of things and say whether we should have the death penalty at all or not. But I think as long as Texas is going to insist on carrying out executions, they need to do so in the most humane way possible, if there is a humane way. And so at least this legislation would move us in the direction of not causing people unnecessary and grievous suffering in putting them to death.
Now, Professor, would the proposals fix any of these longstanding problems or have potentially far-reaching impacts?
I think that a couple of things that are on the table could fix longstanding problems. One is the current Texas death penalty sentencing statute is written in a way that is somewhat confusing, because what it says, there are, as you all know, yes or no questions that the jury has to answer at the punishment phase. And the instructions tell the jury that they have to be unanimous to answer yes, but they have to have at least 10 people to answer no. And that often causes jurors who might have reservations about whether the death penalty is appropriate to think that their vote doesn't matter unless they can get 9 other people to vote with them. When in fact, the law says that if it's not a unanimous vote for death, the sentence has to be life in prison. And so there is at least one proposal on the table to rewrite the statute to tell the jury very directly and very clearly that a unanimous vote for death is required to have death, and that anything short of that will produce a life sentence, which I think is a kind of improving the information we provide to the jurors so that they have a better idea of what the process is and what their role in it is. So that's one longstanding problem. A second one is, you know, in Texas, we've had a lot of attention over the years to the so-called law of parties, which is the rule, the legal rule under which someone can be held responsible for the actions of somebody else. So, for example, if you are a getaway driver in a crime where someone is killed, the law of parties allows you as the getaway driver, potentially at least, to be punished just as seriously as the person who actually inflicted the fatal injury. And that has caused, you know, we've had a number of cases over the years where people have been executed whose role in the crime was decidedly and just undisputedly less than people who escaped execution because they made a deal with the state or they testified for the prosecution or otherwise took themselves out of the line of fire. And so that proposal, there is a proposal to eliminate the death penalty for people convicted under the law of parties, which I think would be a dramatic improvement and would have far-reaching impact because so many cases, especially cases involving younger defendants, people who are 18, 19, 20 years old, involve groups of people committing the crime together because youths often commit criminal acts together. That's part of the characteristic of juvenile crime. And so, you know, that limiting the death penalty so it wouldn't reach people who didn't inflict the actual homicide would be a positive change.
Professor Owen, I want to stop you for just a moment. And let's please go to our reporter outside of the death house, Linda Snyder.
The system has to be overthrown.
Yes, the witnesses came across at 7:40.
That is why we have to begin to talk, not just about peace, but about power.
But he's at peace.
Not just about fixing things, but having a revolution of the heart, a revolution of the mind, a revolution of the soul.
Thank you, Linda. Awesome. Thank you so much. And I'm afraid we've lost Linda, but KPRC, which is a local television station here in Houston, is reporting that the time of death was 6:37 this evening. Arthur Brown is no longer of this mortal earth. I have one more guest to bring in this evening, and I apologize for not doing it earlier. It's another one of our criminal defense attorneys, Meryl Pontier. Meryl, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Do you have any questions for the professor?
No, I was just to get back on what he said about who's determining, you know, the solitary confinement or what is solitary confinement in relation to the recent lawsuit that was filed. I did some research on solitary confinement and published an article about it. You know, international standards define what solitary confinement is, and it is 22 hours a day in a cell without meaningful human contact. And if you look at all the recent lawsuits that were filed in other states, and there's 8. One actually made it to court where they won, also in a trial court and then on appeal. And the 7 other lawsuits that were filed, they were all successful, but they reached an agreement. They reached a settlement. And so when they reached that settlement, both parties agreed on what the new conditions were going to be like. And so they, in fact, determined what is solitary, what's not solitary, and what can we agree on. And so that's hopeful for Texas because also the attorneys who filed in Texas were the same group of attorneys who filed in South Carolina. And South Carolina was successful and they reached a settlement too. They reached an agreement and those people were all taken out of solitary confinement.
May I ask?
Of course, absolutely.
Well, I just wanted to bring this back to you and after that, perhaps to Professor Owen, I've seen long-term impacts on clients that were in solitary. Have you seen that same thing? And do you want to turn that question to Clinton or would you prefer to answer it? Have you seen the long-term impacts of solitary confinement in clients?
Was something in the term of like what happened to Terrence Andres, who just took his own life in January, the 21st of January, after struggling with mental illness. Have you seen any of that up close?
Ms. Pontier, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Mm. Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure who the question was.
That was to you.
I wasn't.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
You first, and then Professor Owen, and then Clinton.
Of course, I've seen those effects, and those effects are horrible. And, you know, when I did my research, those effects come into play after, you know, putting someone in solitary confinement for just a few days. That's when it starts to have its mental effects. And everyone knows in Texas, they keep them in solitary sometimes for decades. And, you know, Texas is one of very few Western countries where they still keep them in solitary on an automatic basis indefinitely based on the sentence instead of prison conduct. And they only do it for people on death row, because I looked at the sentencing or the housing procedures for all other inmates in all states, all including Texas, and every prisoner is based on a certain security level based on conduct, not on sentence. And so people with a death sentence are definitely outliers in that they get an indefinite placement automatically in solitary confinement. But yeah, not that.
Well, unfortunately, at this point in time, I hate to tell you this, but we are going to have to wrap up our session today. I do want to thank everyone. I want to thank Merrill. I want to thank Clinton. I want to thank our guest, Professor Rob Owen. I want to thank our legal analysts, Larry Douglas, Pat McCann, and Merrill Pontier, our reporters, Linda Snyder, and Clinton Young. I want to thank our video director, Mark Pirtle, our technical director, Otis McClay, engineer, Howard Reynolds, social media, Zara Sheridan, and Elise Binch, our executive producer, Elizabeth Ann Stein. And I would like to thank those of you who made a donation to KPFT for Execution Watch. We appreciate you more than you know. It's a very easy thing to do. I am so grateful to those of you who went ahead and made that pledge of support to kpft.org. For those of you who are listening on KPFT 90.1 FM, please stay tuned for People of Earth with Jacqueline Batiste. And on behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.